My typical advice to anyone that is starting a journey with a new company is assessing where we are in that scale of like 0 to 100, 1 to 10, whatever your scaling might be. How advanced are you? Is it trying to solve the foundational problems of perhaps integrating all your data into a centralized database? Or are you far beyond that in a more advanced landscape? And then building your journey from there.
Welcome to the Data Minds podcast, Stephanie. How's your morning been so far?
It is going well. Thanks so much for having me. I am looking forward to the weekend, although it is quite dark and gloomy here in Dallas today.
I know. I think we both are just getting adjusted to time change in the U.S. and the really early darkness that is now upon us. It's not time to put up Christmas lights, but I definitely want to put up some Christmas lights just to add a little bit more cheer into my life, because I'm like, I can't handle all this darkness. I need some more sunshine.
Yes, yes. I'm seeing the transition in my community. It was all of Halloween decorations, and now seeing all that come down and Christmas stuff going up. Although I have not put up Christmas lights or Christmas decor or Christmas tree in probably over maybe 15 years. Because there was this one year where I still had my tree up on Valentine's Day. And as a result, I was like, you know what? This is just way too much work. I'll just wait until we have kids or something of that nature where it's worthwhile.
I have been there before. So the first Christmas to celebrate with my husband, he just loved all the decorations. And he was like, don't put it down yet. Don't put it down yet. And finally, the Valentine's Day was rolling around, and I was like, okay, this is the next holiday. We have to take this down before, like, yes. For me, like, that's the rule. Like, it should probably be taken down in January, but I'm like, we got to get this out of here before Valentine's Day, because it's too much. So yeah. I'm happy to hear I'm not the only one who's been in that situation before.
Putting it up is so much fun. Taking it down, not so much fun.
Right? I wish there was just some magical button to make it all go poof, and maybe one day. Maybe we'll have some little AI bots or who knows to help us. Like, that would be great. I'd love some little AI Christmas decoration bots to help put up and keep things down.
That's
an idea for anybody out there.
Right.
So you've had an amazing career journey. I'm just looking at all the different companies that you've worked at, like Red Hat and Xerox and Office Depot and Memorial Healthcare System. You have spanned a wide range of industries and roles, but all same within, I'm saying, probably like the analytics space, if that's fair. So first of all, can you just share, you know, what's been like to work in the analytics space, but for different industries? Like, how has that changed the work you do? Or is it all the same, like analytics and data is analytics and data, and it doesn't matter if you're at Red Hat or Office Depot or a healthcare system?
Yeah, great question to sort of kick the conversation off. So yes, I have had quite a journey in the last 17 years that has led me through a number of different roles within different industries. Now, venturing through different industries was not the original plan. However, when I graduated, started my career journey, I wasn't sure what industry I wanted to be in per se. And about halfway through my journey, I realized that I should be intentional about having exposure across different industries, because what that creates is a very diverse perspective that is not siloed based on any one industry. And at the end of the day, data is data, right? It's of course different in applicability based on what it is you're trying to solve and for what industry, but in data architecture, all the way through analysis and analytics, the foundation of it all is very, very much the same.
So can you share some of the key milestones or challenges you've encountered just in your path to becoming a leader in the analytics industry? You mentioned that, you know, at first you weren't as intentional and realized that, hey, I do need to be intentional. What were some of the learnings that you had along the way?
Yeah, so starting out, I graduated with my MBA at 22 years old. So I was pretty young at that time and just took the first job that I could. It was the middle of the recession. And I was lucky enough to land a job with a really renowned healthcare system in South Florida. And I started out as a financial analyst, and within weeks realized that finance is not for me. It is far too black and white. There is very little creativity. It's this long to-do list, and it's so repetitive. And that's where I quickly transitioned to a more technical space. I started putting some of that hardcore skill work that I learned at school to work. And that really led my journey into getting into analytics. And, you know, the term analytics when I was in school in the early 2000s was not even invented yet. I've kind of seen it grow and become this gigantic spearhead in terms of priorities across a number of organizations. And it's not going to go anywhere. It's all about where analytics can take us from a success standpoint all the way through to an insight standpoint. That's really driving a lot of the success for a number of organizations. However, I realized very quickly that it was going to be up to me to go after what I wanted. And I know you mentioned milestones. And one of my biggest milestones was also a challenge and kind of that pivotal moment in my career where I realized that no one's going to hand anything to me. I have to go in the end and, you know, grab everything that I can all by myself. But it takes me about, I want to say, 4 or 5 years into my career. And it's a very vivid memory because it's one of those emotional things that I've carried along with me. But also the biggest thing that has happened that has really corrupted my career as well. And at the time, I was working as an analyst for that healthcare company. And there were a number of really great projects and initiatives I was working on and doing a really, really good job. In fact, the VP of the company would often refer to me as her golden child. So I felt, you know, proud. I knew that I was doing a good job. And I'll never forget this one day that my coworker was promoted. And I felt a sort of a moment of disparity, right? Like, what is happening? What did I do wrong? How did I, why am I not promoted too? And it's that sort of vivid memory of going home and just feeling utterly disappointed that you worked so hard and you were not rewarded, right? The next day, gained the courage to go to that VP's office and ask her, well, so-and-so is promoted. Why haven't I been promoted? And she paused for a couple of seconds. And I remember like sweat on my hands and I was so nervous because I wasn't sure what the response was going to be in terms of speaking up, right? And having a voice in that capacity. And to my dismay, her response was, you're absolutely right. You deserve a promotion. I'll make it happen. And literally within a week, I was promoted to the title that I wanted, substantial pay raise, and was given all the recognition that I knew that I deserved, which was amazing and so thankful to have had that opportunity. But in reflection, many, many years later, through and through, it goes back to, well, it shouldn't have taken me to get to that emotional state of almost leaving the company because of disappointment or something that I should have been rewarded from or rewarded to for the beginning. And that was a lesson learned for me is that if you know you're doing a good job, you know that you should be rewarded, go on and ask for it, right? And go after what you think that you deserve, because sometimes it's not going to just be given to you or be placed in your lap, although sometimes it may feel like it should be. And that's also kind of crafted my leadership skills as well. And a part of my leadership style is to be ahead of that, to making sure that I'm thankful for the work that my team is doing and showing them that thankfulness by rewarding them with what's deserved.
Yeah, so many amazing lessons in that story. And thank you for sharing it. I think those really practical stories are where we all learn from, because I just, you know, so many of them have been in that situation where I feel like we're doing all the right things and then performance review comes around and it's not as great as we thought, or other people get promoted. And one, just to have like the courage to go into the office at that point, because, you know, normally when that happens, you're feeling down on yourself. You're not having as much like courage and tenacity as you normally would, right? So to be able to go and to ask it, I mean, the outcome could have gone multiple ways, but it's great to hear that had a really positive outcome in your situation. And I think it's just a great reminder for all of us that, you know, we hope that people recognize your efforts and see it. But if they don't, like, that's still an opportunity to go back and either get feedback or say, hey, like, when's it going to happen? And maybe they just said, oh, my goodness, we totally missed it. Like, this, we're going to make that right now. So thank you for sharing that story. Today, you are leading the data analytics and modernization at UPS. And I really want to dive into this because I think there are so many organizations that are fantastic organizations that are modernizing their systems and really want to become more data-driven. But it is a very different role to be one of those change makers, right? To be one of the change makers leading and saying, hey, we've done it one way for a long time. We're going to do it a new way. What have you seen? What is like the culture of somebody who's going to lead a modernization? What type of characteristics do you need to have to be able to take that charge?
Great question. The biggest characteristic would be, I would say, to be as fearless as possible, as difficult as that may be and that may sound. Those that are leading the charge in terms of driving change through analytics, digital transformation, driving any sort of innovation within an organization, you have to be comfortable with having a level of uncertainty of what that answer is going to be. And you almost have to be a skilled negotiator, right? Because oftentimes you're challenging processes or things or even reports and, you know, at a very, very baseline level, a reporting structure that may have been around for a very, very long time. That works, right? More than odds and the not, it works. But sometimes it's about changing the way that we do things for the better and optimizing the experience, which can result in, of course, cost efficiencies and optimization across an organization and getting to the answers that we need faster, quicker. So you have to be able to play that role of being a negotiator, but also letting them see this is why we need to do things, right? And asking the hard questions of, well, why are you doing it this way? And really understanding and building that connection with your stakeholders. So you understand their perspective and you kind of build your negotiation strategy around that. And something that I've learned through the course of my career is building trusting relationships with your stakeholders is so, so key. You are more likely to drive change and be successful in that and gain adoption and gain buy-in if your stakeholders trust you. So super important to spend the time to build those relationships and of course, beyond the work, beyond the data, beyond what we're trying to do, truly understand who each person is. And that really goes a long, long way.
Yeah, I think that if we could double click into that building trust, because it is so essential, whether it's you're leading change or even just as an individual contributor, right? Building trust with your manager, with your colleagues, it is a game changer in the work you're doing when you have that trust established. And over me, when I switched companies, one of the hardest things is I realized I had built a lot of trust at the previous company, and not that people didn't trust me coming in, but I was new. And so you're starting over when you switch companies. And so you got to get really good. And how do I build trust quickly so I can start to do some of the things that I want to accomplish? Do you have any tips for people on ways to strategically and effectively build trust?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So I've gone through this scenario quite a few times, having gone through a number of different companies throughout my career journey. To me, it's getting the FaceTime in, of course, virtual or in person, both work, right? There's some feedback and sometimes hesitance to the virtual world. I think you can make it work. I think it's that right off the bat, what I typically like to do for myself as well as for my teams is craft a list or have a list crafted for me of key folks that I should meet and learn about. Not necessarily who I'm going to be working with, but anyone throughout the organization so I can start to build a perspective on who they are individually, but also the company culture. So all walks of life, whether it's in sales or marketing or operations, all the way through to like HR and even IT. And I'll typically spend the first couple of months doing these one-on-ones or introductional sort of conversations like this, introducing them about and telling them a little bit about me, but being very social with it and having that same conversation and really kind of trying to dig what their priorities are, what are they trying to accomplish. There's a lot of learning that can be done from both ends. And that's typically one of the strategies that I have worked really, really well for me. There's also a really fantastic book that I often recommend to just about everyone. It's called The First 90 Days. I actually have it, that blue book on my shelf over there. Really great read. It's not necessarily about building an action plan for the first 90 days, but it's more about the persona that you should be curating to win people over and to build your beginning of a tenure within a company. So it's one of those things that I would certainly recommend, especially if you're starting out.
That's fantastic. I'll definitely take a look at that because I know so much is based on one, first impressions for people, but then, you know, the first 90 day key. And I would say you're probably a pro at it, given all the different companies you've worked at, you know, able to quickly build that trust and switch and make sure that productive action happens quickly as well. So, but back to the modernization side of things, when we think about modernization, what is it in analytics that typically needs modernized? Is it first the architecture, and then we need to have the right skills and the right outcomes? Or how do you start to think about what to tackle in that modernization process?
Yeah, so it's sort of all of the above and really depends on the complexity of the organization as well as where they are in the state of their analytics journey. And in some cases, for example, when I was at Red Hat, big tech company, they have got their data foundation in a perfect state, if you will. So the foundational stuff like data architecture, data cleansing, data quality, data governance was already solved for. So the problems there were more in the forefront, right? So being able to put out actionable insights really quickly. Culture EPS is a little bit more on the traditional side, right? So much different landscape. The company's been around, as you know, for 100 plus years. And with that comes very traditional culture. We still have data systems from the 1980s and maybe even before that. We still have mainframe presence, which predates my career. And of course, we need to honor the reason behind why these things still exist. But our journey is very different from that of a Red Hat because we have to solve those foundational problems first. But my typical advice to anyone that is starting a journey with a company is assessing where we in that scale of like 0 to 1 to 10, whatever your scaling might be. How advanced are you? Or is it trying to solve the foundational problems of perhaps integrating all your data into a centralized database? Or are you far beyond that in the advanced landscape? And then building your journey from there. So current prioritization at UPS, it's a little bit of all of the above. A lot of our priorities are simply to modernize our data landscapes. So moving towards a cloud-based platform and starting to introduce data visualization beyond just Excel or PowerPoint. So starting with the basics, but it's a much larger problem to tackle because the company is so large.
Yeah. So how to balance the need for innovation, but also, you know, the practical challenges with large organizations when implementing these new technologies?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really important to see the reality of your current situation. Really great example of that is, you know, AI is the hottest topic. Every single conversation or meeting or lunch or dinner that I have, AI finds its way to the conversation, especially with ChatGPT being sort of pushed out to the public for consumption earlier this year. So there's a lot of questions of, okay, AI is here. What do we do now? And my perspective is, listen, there are a lot of really neat technologies out there that are AI-driven, including generative AI products like ChatGPT that we could certainly use to enhance the experience of our teams as well as our customers. But we need to solve for the underlying foundation first, right? So, and that kind of goes back to the tried and true saying, we're garbage in, garbage out. If we are feeding AI garbage data, the output is going to be garbage as well. And something to really think about, particular to AI, is these bots learn from us. And if we are not cognizant of what we're feeding these things, then what we're assuming is factual or true or vetted that is coming out of these tools as a product can really skew our results. So just something to be cognizant of. But kind of going back to driving innovation, I think it's important to be mindful of where we want to be and laying out a long-term plan. And that's typically how I like to start out roles, having sort of short-term goals, what I want to achieve in the next, of course, 90 days all the way through a year. And then where do I want to be 5 years from now? Where do I want to take the organization as well as my teams? Do we want to expand into a different space? Do we want to bring in new technologies? And really craft that roadmap to get there and build on that strategy. And UPS is learning more and more, especially in the technical capacity, that there's a lot of importance in strategic roadmaps and being able to collaborate those across the organization because there's a lot of decentralization. A lot of large companies like BPS are probably facing the same challenges where you might be on a hub and spoke model, but there are thousands of spokes that nobody's talking to each other. So trying to solve that at the very get-go is central to the success of any sort of innovation.
So in addition to your work at EPS, you're also a professor of business analytics at Drei University. Tell me a little bit about how you got started in that and what made you want to become a professor. I mean, I'm sure you're plenty busy with your full-time job. You know, this sounds like it may be a passion project and an opportunity to give back, but, you know, what made you decide to become a professor?
Yeah, great question. So I am a DeVry alum. I went to DeVry University for my undergrad in computer information systems. And then I continued on to my MBA with Keller Graduate School of Management. That's a branch of DeVry. When I was a child, I wanted to be a teacher. And my sisters will tell you that during summer, I would set up a classroom in our home library. My parents always had like a home office for all the kids. You all had desks and a computer and all that. And my dad's very technologically forward. But I forced my sisters to sit in my summer classroom and make them learn things and do homework. And I give them A's and B's and F's. And this went on for years because I really, really wanted to be a teacher when I was a kid. Then I hit about, I want to say like late middle school, maybe seventh or eighth grade. And I started being curious in the dollars associated to careers. And quickly found that teachers are grossly underpaid, which is, you know, something that we as a population need to solve for. But I quickly pivoted from that ambition because of that reason. However, it is something that I've always been passionate about. And so fast forward to current state, I am a very active DeVry alum and participate in a lot of speaking events and sort of talks with students. And I sit on the DeVry Scholarship Fund as a board member as well. And Elise, who is actually just promoted to CEO of DeVry, reached out to me last year asking if I was interested in becoming a visiting professor. And of course, the answer was yes. So like, how do I sign up for this? So I teach one class of business analytics. It's obviously a topic that I am very, very passionate about. And what's really unique about my ability as a professor is I can attach all of my academic teachings to real life use cases, to real life scenarios, and really talk to the students around, this is what the tech says, but this is how it really works in real life. And that's worked really, really well for me. So like you said, passion project, of course, but it's sort of like bringing that dream of when I was a kid and wanted to be a teacher to life. And it's so rewarding to get the feedback from students where I've had a number of students I've been teaching now for almost over a year now. And I've had a number of students really ramp up their passion and want to move into analytics, which for me is a win-win.
That's incredible. I'm so happy to hear that this was a childhood dream and it's something that you were able to fulfill. What I am doing a lot as a child is I love setting up my Polly Pockets and I never play with them. I just like organize them. So I don't know, maybe I have like, you know, some childhood dream of being a house organizer or something. I don't know what that all translates to, but yours seems very practical. You were able to give all your siblings some summer school and give them a little education.
It looks fun for me, not so much fun for them.
Siblings are great. They go along with it, though. It's fantastic. So I'm sure that your students now today, though, are really getting a lot of benefit, particularly with those practical use cases, as someone who's in the industry today can talk a lot about how it's evolving, how it's changing. It's not just this textbook, you know, here's how it works, but real life scenarios, which is so essential at this, particularly in this type of work as it's ever evolving with the new technologies that we have coming in. In addition to your work at DeVry, you also are a big supporter of women in technology. What advice do you have for other women in technology who are maybe facing any barriers or stereotypes being in a particularly male-dominated field?
It's been interesting to see how much women in data has become a sort of focused topic or a topic of choice among women. I will say that earlier in my career, I didn't really realize that I was an outlier in the tech world. I didn't really pay attention to the fact that there were mostly men in terms of who I was working with. However, when I took my very first managerial role at Office Depot, that sort of lended its way into me realizing that, hey, that there is a needle even that we need to push, because more often than not, I am the only female voice at the table. And more often than not, I am also the only person that is trying to shake things up, transform, and add new technology versus those that may be more reluctant to venture outside into the unknown. So in the last, I would say, maybe 8 or 9 years, something that I have started to talk about, and taking a look at stats and all of the real life data that says that women are a minority, especially in the tech world. The last Gartner report that went out said that 1 in 4 C-suite leaders are women. That's not a huge, and they were saying it as if that was a good thing. And to me, like, yes, we are moving the needle, but it hasn't moved enough. And so being a person that is very woman-centric, and, you know, my husband will tell you that I'm always like, women empowerment, I can do this, I can do anything, I'm stronger than you. Speaking to that, it really goes through into my career and the observations I've made. And it's been a wonderful experience to have to join UPS, where our CEO is a female. And she is amazing. She has such a fun personality. She dresses up. She's got the most quirky things to say. And it's nice to see that that's the way the world is moving. And that was what really drives the passion there. Another thing I'd love to mention as well is just getting that point across to our youth, especially the middle schoolers that are wondering, like, where am I going in life? What do I want to study? And more often than not, they're considering more female-centric roles, right? Like going into nursing, for example, or going into dentistry, for example. However, I think the reality is that the opportunities are endless, regardless of who you are, what you are, where you're from, whether it's cultural diversity, gender diversity, whatever it may be. The possibilities to me are always endless, but getting that point across and that messaging across is sometimes difficult. So having those conversations with our youth, I think it's really important, really, really important to move that needle.
I love it. Yes. It is so exciting to see more and more women just being their authentic self. You know, I think one of the things that can be really difficult is that when you are in a minority group, it's easy to try and change yourself so that you blend in because you don't want it. You're already standing out, right? So you're like, I don't want to stand out anymore. But to have leaders like your CEO at UPS who, you know, is showing up authentically helps just pave the way for so many more to show up and do the same. And so I want to thank you for also being one of those individuals and taking the time today to come in and share your life lessons, what you've learned, and some of the challenges but opportunities that come with analytics modernization. If individuals want to stay connected with you, we'll be sure to include your LinkedIn in the show notes. Any last words before we wrap up here today?
Absolutely. Feel free to reach out. I'm always happy to have a conversation, whether it's career-related, work-related, or personally related. Always happy to make those connections. So if you're interested, of course, shoot a connection to me on LinkedIn. I do want to say thank you so much for having me. Such a great honor to be able to not only tell my story, but hopefully make an impact to an individual watching and or listening in to let them know that, hey, the possibilities are endless for women. You don't have to change who you are to fit the mold. You can continue to be exactly who you are, whether it's, you know, related to fashion or personality or culture. Be who you are, but still go after what you want to do, and don't let anyone ever tell you no, because in my vocabulary, the word no doesn't exist. So good luck to everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Stephanie. And a big thank you to all our listeners. This wouldn't be possible without you. Remember to stay curious and keep learning, and we'll catch you next time on the Data Bites podcast. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Data Bites podcast. If you're looking for more resources to further your data career or find your tribe, we encourage you to become a member at womenindata.org. See you on the other side.